I'm Mike Collins. We all have a little voice in our head. We may not actually hear it as such, but it talks to us all the time. Often that voice can be helpful, cautioning us to be prudent or acting as a wise, all-seeing, all-knowing advisor. But at other times, it can be our harshest critic. It can say things that simply shut us down, filling us with self-doubt. In short, it can be crippling. ABC's Dan Harris heard that voice in his head. To the outside world, to those of us watching him on television, he seemed to have it all. Let's face it, most people in journalism don't make it to the upper echelons of network television, but Dan did at a relatively young age. Then one day, on Good Morning America, in front of about 5 million people, Dan Harris lost the battle with that voice in his head. He had a meltdown. On TV, you can see the fear in his eyes. On radio, you can hear it in his voice as he struggles to breathe while delivering the news.
From ABC News, this is Good Morning America.
We're going to go now to Dan Harris, who's at the news desk. Dan.
Good morning, Charlie and Diane. Health news now. One of the world's most commonly prescribed medications may be providing a big bonus. Researchers report people who take cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins for at least 5 years may also lower their risk for cancer. But it's too early to prescribe statins slowly for cancer production. That does it for news. We're going to go back now to Robin and Charlie.
All right. Thanks very much, Dan Harris at the news desk.
Panic led quickly to humiliation, which set Dan Harris on a journey of survival to get that voice in his head under control. He ended up investigating something he'd always been skeptical about, only to become a true believer. He writes about it and his journey before and after that moment on TV in his New York Times bestseller, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. A true story. Dan Harris, anchor of ABC's Nightline and Good Morning America Weekend Edition, joins us for the hour. Dan, good morning and welcome. Oh, let me turn you on, Dan. I'm having a panic attack. I forgot to turn you on. Good morning and welcome, Dan. Nice to have you here.
The hour may be better, actually, if you leave me on mute.
Okay. Talk about what was going on with you physically in that moment on television.
Classic fight or flight syndrome, you know, when it's a evolutionary fact of human existence that we have this fight or flight impulse when confronted with what our brain perceives rightly or wrongly to be a real threat. Our brain is flooded with adrenaline and your mouth dries up, your heart starts racing, your palm starts sweating, your lungs seize up, and so for me it was flight. That was everything in my body wanted to run away from the fear that was the result of knowing that I was on camera.
That was in 2004. It's 4 years after you joined the network, so you weren't. That wasn't your first day at work. I think you were 28 years old, if I'm not mistaken, at the time. Young age for a TV reporter, but you had survived 4 years of what most people don't understand to be intense competition in that newsroom in New York. You'd been a war correspondent. You'd been to war zones where bullets were flying around you. What was it about that newscast that morning that led to that panic attack?
I don't know why the conditions came together for that morning specifically, but I know generally what had happened. I had arrived, as you said, at the age of 28 in the year 2000, and then not long after I arrived, 9/11 happened, and I, being an ambitious, striving young man, volunteered to go overseas to cover whatever happened next, and ended up spending a lot of time in war zones, and had then come home and gotten depressed, although was not self-aware enough to know I was depressed. At which point I did an incredibly stupid thing, which is I started to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy, which made me feel better, sort of replaced the adrenaline that I had become addicted to in the war zones, really. And even though I was only using drugs intermittently, really not a heavy user, but it was enough, I later learned, too late, to artificially raise the level of adrenaline in my brain and just make me more susceptible to panic. And I always had a sort of low-level stage fright, and still have. Every time I go on the air, I'm I'm a little bit nervous, even though I've been doing it, you know, for most of my life. And so I think all of those conditions combined on that morning to make a really terrible day. And it was only after the panic attack that I realized that the drug use was a contributory factor for sure, because I went to a shrink who pointed it out to me, and so I started to make some changes after that.
But in your book, you also write about prior to that attack, prior to all those things coming into place, that when you got to the network at this young age, you were hired to do an all-night show on ABC that probably very few people watched, but Anderson Cooper was leaving to do something else, and he decided when you got there not to leave, and so they pushed you into a different department of ABC, which gave you more of an exposure, and you found yourself there against all these other people who were more seasoned. You were green, they were seasoned, and they didn't talk to you. And so your compensation for that was to what? Become a workaholic, right?
Yeah, I had a motto that was bequeathed to me by my father, who's an academic physician up in Boston. His motto was, the price of security is insecurity. And so it'll shock your viewers to hear that my father is a Jew. So I had this sort of neurotic Woody Allen-esque Jewish father in my head, with this idea that the intensity of your anxiety loop, it will be directly correlated to whatever success you may achieve. And so I was always worrying about, you know, how good was my last story? How good will my next story be? Is somebody getting a story that I want? What's my relationship with the bosses, the anchors, et cetera, et cetera. And that voice in my head was really, you know, a big part of why I went off to war zones and without really thinking about the consequences. So I'd never really had a panic attack before. I had had, you know, maybe little bits of really bad stage fright at points in my career, but I'd never had anything like what I experienced on that morning in June.
So that panic attack, was it simply the need for adrenaline or the adrenaline kicking in from recreational drug use, or was it also just all this residual stuff, this need to compete, this need to achieve, this need to prove yourself that came from being there at a very young age against all these people who have been around for a long time and the pressure cooker environment that is network news, where if you don't compete with a rapier, you're going to be stabbed by somebody else's.
It's hard to mathematically divide up what the component parts of the panic attack were. I say this after having spent a lot of time talking about it with my shrink, who is an expert in panic. I think the major contributing factor was cocaine. And again, I want to be clear, I wasn't high on the air, but I had done enough cocaine in the preceding year or so that it was just, raised my overall baseline level of adrenaline. To me, I think that was the biggest factor, plus a sort of a baseline penchant, for stage fright. But at that point in my career, 4 years, I was 32 at the time. I was 4 years into my career at ABC News. I was much more secure at that point than I was when I arrived at 28. So it really wasn't at that point the competition that was screwing me up. Although once I got into the panic, once the panic kicked in, part of the, you know, what panic really is anxiety on steroids, right? So anxiety is worrying about the future, and panic is just massive, hurricane level, gale force wind anxiety, where you are, you know, worrying about, you know, the past and the future. And I'm part of the component of the internal concern at that moment was, oh, everybody's seeing this, my career is over. And that just, you know, that just fed into the physical symptoms of the heart racing and the mind and the palms sweating and the lungs seizing up, and then that made the voice in the head even worse, which made the physical symptoms even worse, and it just kind of spiraled downward from there.
And you say that although you have an addictive person, you've come to discover that you have an addictive personality. As a young person in college and high school, you didn't do drugs. You did drugs after you came back from the war zone. Did you do that simply for recreational use? Did you do it to deal with this undiagnosed depression? Did you do it because you wanted to quiet the voice in your head? Why did you do it?
Well, yeah, so that is absolutely true. I had definitely from a young age, smoked a little weed and drank a little bit, but not in a problematic way.
Mm-hmm.
I never really liked either of those things enough to become compulsive about it. I did have an addictive personality with things like, when I was a little kid, like cake, or my parents really had to police my sugar intake and things like that. But I didn't have a huge problematic relationship to substances. It really wasn't until in my 30s that I first started using drugs. And, I didn't put it together at the time, but it is now obvious to me that I was depressed, largely, I think, because I was missing the adrenaline, the thrill of being in a war zone. And I was feeling down and sort of decrepit a little bit. I felt, really low energy. And one night, on a whim, a friend of mine offered me some cocaine, and I said yes, after having said no every other time it had come up at a party or something like that. And when I did it, when I tried it that first time, it made me feel better. And it felt a little bit like being back at the war zone. It was that same kind of heightened feeling.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, then from that point on, it's not like I was doing it every day, but I would, once or twice a month or something like that, I would be at a party and I would do it. And it made me feel better. And it was just a really stupid, stupid thing to do. And in my view, is what led to the panic attacks, and I think cutting it out is what has stopped the panic attacks from is one huge factor in what has stopped the panic attacks from recurring.
Well, I said in the beginning that this panic attack, and it was not just one; there was one later on that you kind of got under control. But this set you on a journey. Is that how it unfolded? Is that in fact what you did? Did you start seeking things out? Did you see yourself on this journey? Or did that just kind of happen after you saw the first psychiatrist or psychologist?
No, I definitely didn't think I was on a journey. I was not the type of person who wanted to be on a journey. Mm-hmm. I was not really curious about or interested in, spirituality or anything like that. I thought it was all of that was kind of stupid. So really, I got put on the journey involuntarily. The first thing that happened was, I had the panic attack, and I stopped doing drugs, and I agreed to go see this shrink once or twice a week indefinitely. So I was on the journey of psychotherapy at that point. And then the other thing that happened was that my boss, Peter Jennings, assigned me to cover faith and spirituality for ABC News, which I really didn't want to do because I was raised in the People's Republic of Massachusetts, both my parents are scientists, and I really had no interest in spirituality or metaphysics. I did, as I like to joke, I did have a bar mitzvah, but only for the money. So I had no interest in being on any sort of journey, but
nonetheless, the journey you took, and we'll talk about that and where it took you when we come back from the break. ABC's Dan Harris. His book is called 10% Happier. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Henrik Acura. Test drives available and new 2016 inventory now arriving daily for winter, including available super handling all-wheel drive models. More at HenrikAcura.com. For decades, race and public education have been two sides of the same coin, and the discussion of those two topics is unfolding again as the school board here in Charlotte talks about pupil assignment to break up its pockets of poverty. We don't always recognize race or racism in ourselves, but there's a new film aimed at getting kids to talk about this topic, what it means, and what it looks like. And we'll hear from the film's producer on this program tomorrow at 9. Tomorrow at 7, we are doing this show, 7 p.m. We are doing this show live from Winthrop University as part of a town hall discussion on the South Carolina primaries. And you're invited to be part of the audience in that live broadcast. All you have to do is go to our website, WFAE.org, for details and to RSVP.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the murder of a 13-year-old Virginia girl has raised concerns about anonymous messaging apps. Millions of American teenagers use services like Kik and Yik Yak that police say have been linked to a growing number of crimes. What parents and teens need to know.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. ABC's Dan Harris is with us, the anchor of Good Morning America Weekend Edition and Nightline. His book is called 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, A True Story. The title of that book is longer than many network newscasts. It's it's amazing. So we talked about your panic attack on the air, which led to you're trying to figure out what was going on, and that your psychiatrist, your shrink, said it's drug use. It's recreational drug use. And you also were directed to read a book by a producer at ABC, and you ultimately met the author of this book. It's Eckhart Tolle. Is that how you say his name?
I think you say he pronounces it Eckhart Tolle. Tolle,
okay. And you say you were captivated by his description of the human condition. Why? You recognized it as yours?
Yeah, so just to finish what I was saying before the break, that I had been assigned to cover faith and spirituality
right.
for ABC News. I did so reluctantly, but it turned out to be a really good thing for me. I spent a lot of time in mosques and mega churches and Mormon temples and really made a lot of good friends and learned how ignorant I was on the issue. And but nothing spoke to me personally. So while I learned a lot, it didn't make any fundamental changes in my life until the year 2008. So many years after the panic attack and many years after I started covering faith and spirituality, one of my producers recommended that I read this book by Eckhart Tolle, who's a mega best-selling self-help guru. Oprah is a big fan of his, and apparently she she puts copies of his books in every bedroom in every house she owns. And Paris Hilton was seen carrying one of his books when she went into jail for DUI. So I thought, I thought it sounded like sufficiently exotic and strange for a television story, but I didn't think it was going to be anything that would be useful for me. So I ordered one of his books to familiarize myself with him. And initially, I thought it was complete baloney, just filled with all of this spiritual gobbledygook and pseudoscientific claims about, vibrational fields and grandiose assertions like this book was going to create for you a spiritual awakening, whatever that means. And after his own book, A Spiritual Awakening, he says that he lived on a park bench in a state of bliss for 2 years in the city of London, which, I think they have winters in London, so I was a little skeptical about that claim. Nonetheless, I continued to read, and I'm glad I did, because he started to unfurl a thesis about the human situation that I thought was really, really interesting. Tolle's argument is that we all have a voice in our head, by which he was not referring to schizophrenia or hearing voices. He's talking about your inner narrator, the voice that chases you out of bed in the morning and is yammering at you all day long and has you constantly wanting stuff or not wanting stuff, comparing yourself to other people, judging yourself harshly, thinking about the past or the future to the detriment of whatever's happening right now. And, and Tolle's argument is that when you're unaware of this inner narrator, it yanks you around. It's why, you find yourself with your hand in the fridge when you're not hungry, or you're losing your temper when it's strategically unwise, or you're checking your email in the middle of a conversation with your kid. Speaking of kids, my one-year-old is walking up to me right now, so you may hear some unsolicited commentary. and reading this book by Tolle was this huge aha moment for me, because I realized, one, his diagnosis of the human condition was just you know, totally intuitively true, and two, it explained the most embarrassing moment of my life. It explained that on-air panic attack, because the voice in the head is why I went to war zones without thinking about the consequences, came home, got depressed, was insufficiently self-aware to even know it, and then blindly self-medicated with recreational drugs. And so that was a huge aha moment for me.
The other aha moment comes from the fact that you discovered that a lot of his ideas actually did not come from him. They came from the Buddha, who recommended something you always regarded as, and I quote here, uniquely ridiculous, and that is meditation. But that led you to discover mindful meditation. What is mindful meditation?
So, yes, you put it correctly. To shorten the narrative, that background noise is from a one-year-old who has no respect for radio interviews.
Sorry, we have no respect for him. I'm just kidding. No, we we can barely hear it, Dan. We can barely hear it.
Okay, good. Okay. I got interested in Tolle. I found him to be interesting but not useful, because he didn't really have any practical advice for dealing with the voice in the head. And then I ultimately stumbled upon Buddhism, and I realized, most of the interesting stuff that Tolle was talking about seemed to have been lifted from this dude 2,600 years ago called the Buddha. The Buddha did have a very simple piece of advice for dealing with the voice in the head, which was meditation, which I thought was ridiculous. I thought it was only for hippies and freaks and people who live in a yurt and are really into, aromatherapy and Cat Stevens. And I wasn't entirely wrong about that, just for the record. But what I found out was, after some initial sort of repulsion, was that there's actually been an enormous amount of scientific research into meditation. That is very much in its early stages, and I don't want to overhype this scientific research, but I think we can safely say that it strongly suggests a long list of really compelling health benefits. Like, it's been shown to reduce the release of stress hormones in your brain, cortisol, lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system, and literally rewire key parts of your brain. And also what I learned is that the kind of meditation that is mostly being studied in the labs is called mindfulness meditation, and it's secular. It can be practiced by people who have pre-existing religious beliefs or like me, who are sort of respectful agnostics. It's really just exercise for your brain. We can talk about how to do it if you want.
We will talk about how to do it, but I want to bring in another skeptic, initially another skeptic of mindfulness meditation, turned true believer, and that is Dr. Russ Greenfield, who was introduced to mindfulness meditation nearly 20 years ago. He was studying integrative medicine with Dr. Andrew Weil, and today he is director of Greenfield Integrative Healthcare and a clinical professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
We've been hearing this conversation between me and Dan Harris, mindfulness meditation. You too thought this was poppycock. What made you turn the corner?
Well, indeed. When I was first introduced to it, I was like, well, I'm here. I have to learn this. Okay. But in my head, I was like, I like baseball, basketball, and football, and this is never going to work. And my mind is way too busy and on and on and on. And the first time we sat down together to meditate, literally for only 5 minutes, I thought I was going to lose my mind. So then I decided to do something.
Why?
Because I just couldn't sit still. My mind was going crazy. It's like, I just couldn't control it. And I actually thought that was one of the things that I had as a skill, is that I was, quote unquote, a multitasker. I could do these things. And, if you're a multitasker, that's part of how you get ahead. You can do a lot of things and do them well. And that's what I thought. My background was in emergency medicine. You have to be able to do a lot of things all at once. So then I did what you're supposed to do if you're a skeptical scientist. I started looking for the data. And lo and behold, I found there was actually quite a bit of data behind mindfulness meditation and its potential benefits for patients, specifically at that time around pain management. And the important thing here with regards to the science is it wasn't distraction therapy. It was actually activating different portions of the brain that helped with reducing the perception of pain. And so one of the things I think is very, very important when talking about this from a scientific perspective, there's a big difference between there not being any research data supportive of an intervention and our not being aware of the research data that's already been published.
So we have a scientific skeptic who is won over. We have a journalist skeptic who was won over to this. Let me get a definition. I think I asked Dan this a minute ago and he got off onto a tangent, but what is mindfulness meditation?
Well, Dan, I don't know if you want to take this.
Here's how to do it. It's so simple. I actually taught the tech reporter from the New York Times, or one of them, how to do it in fewer letters than it takes to send a tweet. But I will give you the slightly longer version. So the first step, there are three steps for beginners. The first step is to sit comfortably with your back reasonably straight. A lot of people close their eyes, although you don't have to do that. The second step is to just feel, to bring your full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. You pick a spot wherever the breath is most prominent, your nose, your chest, or your belly, and you just feel, it's very simple, try to feel, not think about, but feel the sensations of your breath coming in and going out. And now the third step is the key, because as soon as you try to do this, as the good doctor mentioned, your mind is going to go nuts. You're going to start thinking about, what am I going to have for lunch? Do I need a haircut? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss? Why did Dances with Wolves beat Goodfellas for the best picture in 1991? Whatever. Your mind is going to go crazy. And the whole point is just to notice when you've become distracted and to start again and again and again and again. And every time you do that, it's a bicep curl for your brain. And it shows up on the brain scans and these studies that have been done about mindfulness meditation. And not for nothing, it's also a radical act, because you're breaking a lifetime's habit of walking around in a fog of projection into the future or rumination about the past, and you're actually just focusing on what's happening right now. That's the whole game. There are a million other things we can say about meditation, mindfulness meditation, but that is really what need to know to get started.
Scientifically, doctor, as I tried to do this while Dan was talking, but still listen to Dan. But you feel, as you sit here with your straight back and you breathe in and you feel the air coming into your lungs and going out of your lungs, it just seems to me to be just relaxing more than anything. Is that the key to it? Well, is there more to it than that?
There's more to it, but goodness knows there's nothing wrong with relaxing.
That's true.
So there's the interesting thing here is, you know, we talk about it, you know, are there data and is it in its infancy and things of that nature? You know, this past fall in a journal called PLOS, there was a very interesting study that showed that when patients were introduced and taught how to do mindfulness meditation, there was a 43% reduction in doctor's visits. So when you take a look and see where the data are with regards to utilizing this tool, and as Dan very nicely put, this is not a religious practice. This is a secular practice that people can use together with their spiritual practice, completely apart from it. But the data are quite strong with regards to reducing inflammation, diminishing pain, helping with stress, anxiety, but also helping people really be fully present for the joy in their lives.
But why is it working? What's happening that it does all these things?
Well, there's a lot of research data around this, and not all of it has been explained, to be honest with you, but it activates certain portions of the brain that are actually critically important towards promoting balance.
We've talked on this program before about the origins of many integrative medicine practices, and they come from Eastern medicine. They don't come from Western medicine, and Western medicine has always been skeptical of these things and kind of just pushed them off to the side and said nonsense to them all. These people have been, the Buddhists have been practicing this for 2,600 years, way ahead of the game, it seems to me. Why were they so prescient? Why did they know?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'd be guessing. But I also think it's important to remember that in many other religious traditions, there is also the tradition of meditation, just put in different frameworks. So I think anybody can get their arms around this. And also, when you take a look and see that there's a science backing to this, it's something we all should consider.
Are some of the same, I know people will view prayer and meditation differently, and they are different things, but are some of the same things happening when you sit there and you fervently pray? Are some of the same things happening that happen during meditation, perhaps?
I think it depends on where you are at that moment. As Dan nicely put forth, you want to be fully present in the moment. So if your prayers are being offered in a place where you are fully present with what you are doing and not being distracted, I think that's a very much akin to with regards to what happens with meditation.
Dan, we often hear that people want to meditate because they want to center themselves, and that's always been kind of a I don't know, a foreign concept to me that I couldn't quite understand, to center one's self. Do you understand it?
Yeah, I understand it. I'm not very good at doing it. The one thing that's important to point out is the word meditation is a little bit like the word sports, in that it describes a whole range of activities. So there are meditation exercises that are designed specifically to get you more relaxed and centered. Mindfulness meditation is not one of them.
Okay.
You may feel relaxed, maybe, when you're doing mindfulness meditation, or you may feel the exact opposite of relaxed. You may feel completely restless and crazy, but it doesn't matter. The point of meditation, mindfulness meditation, is not to feel a certain way. It is to feel whatever you feel clearly. Why is that important? Because when you are overtaken by strong emotions or urges or impulses or desires in the rest of your life, you can see those things for what they are and not get carried away by them.
So I was going to ask you
mindfulness meditation.
I was going to ask you, Dan, if this quiets the voice in your head, what I'm hearing you say is that it clarifies the voice in your head. Is that accurate?
Yeah, in the subtitle of the book, we talk about taming the voice in the head. Think about it. I have three rescue cats in my house. They're tame, I guess, as far as it goes, but they still poop on the rug and claw my furniture. So they're not completely quiet. And I think the same thing is true with my mind. I've over 6.5 years of meditating. There's a certain amount of taming that's happened, but I retain the capacity to be a complete schmuck sometimes. And so that's why the book is called 10% Happier. It's not, there is no miracle cure out there. And I think part of my goal in the book is to counter program against the $11 billion a year howling sea of nonsense that is the self-help industry, which promises you all of these miracle cures. There is no such thing. If there was a miracle cure, we wouldn't need all these books. Somebody would have written one book, and that would have solved all of our problems.
Is that part of the problem, Dr. Weil, Dr. Greenfield, that people associate this with hocus pocus, with these self-help books that intrinsically, even though we may read them, we know we didn't get anything out of the last one, so why would we get anything out of this next one? That this is associated with that kind of stuff, and we don't take it seriously. But if we took it seriously, we would benefit from it.
Indeed. It's a barrier that we have to overcome because it becomes, woo-woo medicine. And mm-hmm. then you have to take a look and see that there's actually very good research data.
I know that you helped open the integrative health medical department at CMC but years ago. Did doctors look at you as woo-woo medicine?
A little bit. But, you take a look now, you see almost every major medical center in the nation offers training in mindfulness
right.
meditation because the research, is so compelling and people sincerely benefit from it. And they can use it. Part of what I think is important here is that, the meditation practice is in itself important and you don't have to do it for a very long period of time to benefit. But the idea behind the meditation is actually to learn how to be mindful throughout the course of your day. Not to take every moment-by-moment experience and judge it and place undue meaning on it. It simply is what it is.
How long does it take you to go through this process, Dan? And I only have 30 seconds left in this segment, but how long do you do it, and how many times a day do you do it?
Completely up to you. There's no hard and fast rules. What I would say for beginners is 5 to 10 minutes a day is enough to get started. And I don't care how busy you are, if you have 14 jobs and 75 children, you have 5 minutes to do this. It doesn't need to be something you need to add to your to-do list that is going to further stress you out. That would defeat the purpose. It can be integrated into your daily life quite easily.
Dan Harris, the anchor of Nightline and Good Morning America Weekend Edition and the author of 10% Happier with Dr. Russ Greenfield. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, an agency that helps protect and restore local streams and lakes. Everyone can help prevent water pollution. Details at charmec.stormwater.org. The late Justice Antonin Scalia was the leading conservative voice on the U.S. Supreme Court. His life and legacy and the battle ahead over the makeup of the nation's highest court, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation with ABC's Dan Harris and Dr. Russ Greenfield, now's the time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. But do it mindfully. We're coming right back.
Dana Lumsden, managing partner of the Charlotte office of Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, a WFAE underwriter.
Not everyone who listens to WFAE may be independently wealthy, but they're definitely well-educated listeners, people that have strong opinions, people who are in leadership positions in their organization. Those are the people that we want to know about us, and that's why WFAE was a perfect fit for us.
Underwriting on WFAE says a lot about your business. To learn more, email underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with ABC's Dan Harris and Dr. Russ Greenfield, director of Greenfield Integrative Healthcare. Dan has written a book about how he came to mindfulness after having a panic attack on live television in front of 5 million people. I don't know whether this comes from your book or it comes from an interview that I read that you gave, Dan, but the Buddha calls that voice in your head the monkey mind. And he said, and I quote you here, we're like furry little primates swinging through the jungle of thoughts, urges, and desires, always flinging to things that won't last and constantly lurching from one pleasant experience to the next, never fully satisfied. The pursuit of happiness becomes the source of our unhappiness. As I read that, to me, that sounds like America. That's not a question. It's just a statement. Any reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, it is America, but I also think it's everybody. I think it is universal, too. I think we are, part of being human is this, you're always on the hunt for the next hit of pleasant experience where, we have a great meal or we watch a great movie or we sip a lovely little milky latte and it's awesome. But we're never fully satisfied. We're insatiable.
And that
is the human condition. That is what the Buddha called suffering. Because we're never satisfied. Nothing does it for us.
And it seems that's also our preoccupation to a degree with our cell phones, Doctor. The fact that we cannot not look at our cell phone, even during a dinner or a lunch with a companion, we have to check our phones. We're looking for something, some stimulation, some satisfaction. Could we break that habit by becoming more mindful?
Certainly. And one of the things that many experts say is that actually happiness should not be the goal because, as Dan said, it's always tied to the next thing and the next thing. So perhaps the goal should be peace, or comfort, resilience. All of those things can be supported through a mindfulness practice.
How does mindfulness help the two of you in your daily routine? Because you meditate, correct, Doctor? So let's start with you, and then we'll hear from Dan. How this meditation and this grounding, this centering, this becoming mindful helps you?
I start my day with 5 minutes, and I end my day with 5 minutes. I'm not a guy who's going to sit down and meditate for 30 minutes. That's just my makeup. But during the course of the day, if I have a particularly trying time, I will peel off and simply do a one-minute meditation. Remember that the foundation of almost any meditation practice is a focus on the breath. So anybody can do this, and all it takes is really the opportunity to learn from other people who have done this. I typically recommend taking a class. Because of the experience I had, those first 5 minutes when you sit down and meditate and you think you're going to lose your mind, it's great to be in a class because everybody's about to lose their mind.
I'm going to come back to that. Dan, how does it help you?
I think it makes me less likely to get carried away by the urges and impulses and emotions that drive all of us all the time. So just to quote a friend of mine, it's cut down on the half-life of my anger. Something bad happens, and maybe I'm angry for 2 minutes instead of an hour. And the amount of damage you can do in an hour as opposed to 2 minutes of anger is incalculable. And that is a huge change. It just makes you less likely to, you know, say the thing that's going to ruin the next 48 hours of your marriage, or eat the 18th cookie, or ignore your kid, and all of that is just incredibly valuable. It doesn't make your life a parade of unicorns and rainbows, but it does make it significantly better.
So I was going to ask if this is something that you can learn to do from the simple steps that you've put forward on this program today, Dan, and what you write about in your book, or as you say, Doctor, that your first-timers would benefit from a class. Is this like yoga that you have to go to you have to go to class to learn this?
Well, I would say, you know, you take, if you have the opportunity to read Dan's book, which I like very much, because Dan started out as a skeptic, much like myself, and through his travels and his experiences, he learned something incredibly valuable. So you could do it the way that Dan did. I just think that it might have been easier, and Dan, I'd really be interested to hear your statements around this, to be in a class where other people come together and say, there's no way I can do this. I have the monkey mind. It's just too busy, and I knew I shouldn't have shown up here after the first class, you know, all those kinds of things. And then a couple weeks later, they're actually all sitting together meditating for 10 to 15 minutes.
Dan?
Yeah, I agree. Look, if you can get to a class, if you live in a part of the country where there are classes, and because one of the problems is that there aren't that many qualified teachers, and this is a big issue as meditation becomes more popular, then going to a class is wonderful. Or if you have the time to do it. They're not everybody has the time to do it. Here's another alternative, and this is a self-interested thing I'm about to say, so I apologize in advance.
There's an app for that.
There are apps, right? And,
yes.
And for a long time, the app I recommended, which I still think is a really good app, is Headspace. But there's a new app that I really like. It's coincidentally called 10% Happier. And what I've done is I've signed up my meditation teachers to teach a meditation in conjunction with me, and you can get it in the App Store and try it for 7 days for free, and you'll learn how to meditate with me and with my teacher, who I believe is the greatest living meditation teacher. And it's designed for skeptics. It's designed to be short and easy to use, and it's a way that you can sort of be in the presence of a great teacher even if you can't do it in your local community.
However, I looked for your app in the Google Play Store, Dan, and I couldn't get it. So
I know. You know, well, this company that we started is a couple months old, so we're really very at the germinal stages. And so we are, to our great regret, we are not yet available for Android. However, if you have an Android phone and you go to 10percenthappier.com, you can download it in a way that will allow you to do it through your browser on your phone.
Okay.
And we will have an Android version up at some point.
You say in your book that you always thought that the voice in your head was one of your best assets. How has that voice changed? Has it improved your life in any way because you now listen to it more critically, or you hear it more clearly because of this meditation practice?
Exactly. You are not going to make the voice in your head go away. You're not going to stop thinking, either on the meditation cushion or in the rest of your life. What's going to happen is you'll have a different relationship to the thinking. So I'm aware of the terrible suggestions that the voice in my head is offering up all day long, but I'm much better at turning the other cheek 10% of the time. You know, I'm not infallible. And I still believe, by the way, that the price of security is insecurity. I still believe that a certain amount of stress and plotting and planning is inherent in trying to be great at anything you do. In my case, writing more books, starting a company, continuing to be a journalist. There's a lot of thinking and planning that goes into that. But we tend to make our suffering worse than it needs to be. And so with meditation, I've really learned to draw the line between useless rumination and what I call constructive anguish. And that has made a huge difference. So I'll just close by saying, I am not perfect. And if my wife were here, she would give you the 90% still a moron speech. So I don't want to hold this up as something that's going to solve all of your problems. But, I stand by the whole 10% happier proposition, and I would add that I think it compounds annually like any good investment.
Doctor.
I was going to say, well, Dan, first of all, you know, your honesty and the opportunity to share your skepticism and your journey, I think is invaluable for many of us and for anybody who's interested in exploring mindfulness meditation. I also think something you said was very important, that even though we might practice mindfulness, it doesn't mean that we're really good teachers of it. Here in Charlotte, North Carolina, we're actually really very rich with regards to people who can train us in this. There are Lindsay Bridges, Dale Waxman, Joe Parisi, Ruth King. There's all kinds of folks here in town who are excellent instructors. So we're really quite fortunate here. And if you're interested, there are many classes that you can participate in.
For people just joining us, they may have missed earlier references to the fact that this is not just hocus pocus, that there's scientific evidence that this works and how it's and it's being used medically to treat a lot of conditions. Talk to me just again briefly here about the scientific evidence. How do they measure the impact of mindfulness meditation on people who are practicing it while they're practicing it?
While they're practicing it, they often use a functional MRI. A lot of people have heard about MRI scans and things of that nature. The fMRI, or functional MRI, is used to see what aspects of the brain, what portions of the brain are being activated during a different session or a different activity. And they will utilize this machine, people placed in the MRI machine, and will be meditating. They also do EEG techniques, other things of that nature. And the research data here is really quite extraordinary. There's actually a wealth of research coming out of the University of Wisconsin with a fellow named Richie Davidson, who's done some extraordinary work with people who have meditated for years upon years. And one of the most amazing things, and Dan can speak to this too because he mentioned it in his book, you know, there's something called neuroplasticity. Those people who meditate on a consistent basis actually change the anatomical shape of their brains. I mean, this is extraordinary. It has an impact on the actual shape and even function of the brain.
So you're actually, as I think Dan says in the book, growing gray matter.
Indeed, and that's why when Dan says it's rewiring the brain, it's actually doing that and increasing some of the volume of the brain.
Do we understand why?
Not yet. But, you know, sometimes you don't have to know how something works in order to recommend it. If you've got the outcomes data showing that there's improvements in mood disorders like anxiety, depression, that there's less pain, that there's less inflammation, all these different kinds of things, you know what? We don't have to know how it works in order to recommend it because we know it's safe and potentially effective.
One of our listeners, Brian, has written us an email. It says, please discuss why so many people just run to antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds and don't give mindfulness a chance. I think too many people want to play with the chemicals in their brains. I have two daughters who are in their early and late 20s that think meds are the way to go. I've been practicing mindfulness meditation for years, and I'm trying to get them to give it a real shot first. Well, Dan, I don't think anybody's bet there's anybody better to talk about medication or self-medication versus mindfulness meditation than you.
Yeah, look, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I don't think we should treat meditation as some sort of panacea that will allow you to. That's going to make you immediately and irretrievably happy. I think that it works well with things like medication and getting enough sleep and exercising and having good friends and having a healthy diet. It's just one more arrow in the quiver when we talk about well-being. And it's too long been written off as something for weirdos. And I think we just, once we can get over that cultural hump, I think that it will just be another addition to the pantheon of no-brainers. But I really don't want people to think, you know, I'm not anti-medication, especially if you're doing it in conjunction with a doctor and it's working for you. This is something else to consider, but it doesn't mean it's not a zero-sum game in that sense.
Yeah, you're right, I think, in the book that in 1940, if you told somebody you're going to go out running, they would ask, from what? And so now we all see people running on the street all the time. That's become part of our routine. And you're suggesting that this become an arrow in the quiver, another thing that we add on to our lives.
Yeah, it's true. If you had said to somebody in the 1940s, I'm going running, they would have said, who's chasing you? And what happened next? The scientists swooped in. They showed all the benefits of physical exercise, and now we all do it. And if we don't do it, we feel guilty about it. And that's where I think we're heading with meditation. It's just going to be viewed as exercise for the mind. the same way that running is viewed as exercise for the body.
And this is being adopted by some pretty major players. Google, Procter & Gamble, General Mills, lots of sports teams practice this, individual athletes. I suppose that there are performers who do this as well. Did they get to the table before you did, Dan, before you did, Doctor? Or are they? Is everybody kind of coming along to this at the same time?
Well, I would say, you know, what has been bringing doctors to the table is the research. You know, it's much easier to feel comfortable about saying, okay, this is something I can recommend to patients because I've got these data. But I honestly think in order to do that, we physicians should be trying it ourselves first. That experience is critically important to having authentic relations with folks and speak about this.
And you became a Buddhist, if I'm not mistaken, Dan, but others using these techniques have left the Buddha out of it, and you believe that that's kind of a shame. Why? Because you stress the secular nature.
No, I don't think it's. I think it's totally fine. You know, on our app, the 10% Happier app, we don't talk about the Buddha. I'm a Buddhist, but that's a misleading term.
Okay.
It means both more and less than you might think. Sorry, there's the kid again. the Buddha didn't think he was starting a religion. You know, the term Buddhism didn't come along until millennia after the Buddha died. The Buddha was just teaching a way to feel better. He thought of himself as a doctor, really. And so I don't believe in a lot of the metaphysical claims that I believe were actually tacked on to Buddhism, like karma and rebirth and enlightenment and things like that. Buddhism is not something to believe in. It is something to do. And in that sense, because I do Buddhist meditation, I'm a Buddhist. But in the same way, I'm a journalist. And an American, and lots of other things that aren't necessarily tied up with metaphysical beliefs. So, you know, I am a Buddhist, but it's actually kind of, it requires a little bit of explanation. Now, having said that, there are things that I think that sometimes get lost in the popularization of meditation. And one of the things that I worry about a little bit is compassion. If you study Buddhist meditation, they're going to talk a lot about, like, not being a jerk. As it turns out, we haven't talked about it yet, but there's an enormous amount of scientific research that suggests that meditation, compassion meditation designed to make you nicer, does work. It makes you healthier, makes you happier, and it can change behavior.
Dan Harris, the anchor of Nightline and Good Morning America Weekend Edition, and the author of 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, a True Story. Also with us, Dr. Russ Greenfield, Director of Greenfield Integrative Healthcare. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte.